We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Leon Trotsky was one of the giants of the Russian Revolution, and when Lenin died, Trotsky was the heir apparent. However, he ended up on the losing end of a power struggle with Joseph Stalin. As a result, he was thrown out of the Communist Party, he was exiled from Russia, and he was targeted for assassination. This morning, we will spend some time talking about Trotsky's life and get an assessment of his place in history as we talk with Bertrand Patenaude. He is the author of a new book, Trotsky, Downfall of a Revolutionary, a book that concentrates on the final years of Trotsky's life. It's published by Harper. It's just recently come out. Our guest is lecturer at Stanford University, where he is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution Library and Archives, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Patenaude, hello.
Hello there.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
One certainly could write a very long book treating the life of Trotsky and his role in the tangled history of the Russian Revolution. You're concentrating here on just the last couple of years of his life, the time that he spent in Mexico. What about that chapter, that final chapter of his life, do you find so interesting?
Well, the idea behind this book was to focus on those final years in order to get right up close to the man, in order to see what Trotsky's daily life was like, his likes, his dislikes, his relationships, and so on. But also, what I do in the book is I have flashbacks to those moments, the peaks and valleys of Trotsky's earlier career, so that by the end of the book, you really do have the man in full.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like he would be a difficult man to live with, especially because of his single-minded dedication to his cause. It seems that everything else, including his family, came second.
I think that's right. I think he first of all, is a fanatic about his Marxism-Leninism and his belief that the October Revolution of 1917 was the great moment in history, and that another such moment would come, Stalin would be ousted, and he would return to power. Now, that's on the one hand. On the other hand, as a family man, and as a man with a staff around him of young acolytes, and particularly in these Mexico years, he's very exacting, very demanding, very short-tempered, very difficult to get along with.
And at the same time, there were a lot of people who were truly devoted to him.
Well, this is true. And I think one of the key factors here is that Trotsky got out before the purge trials, before things really got nasty in the 1930s, Stalin had exiled him. And so for the true believers in the West, people who believed in Great October, people who believed in the Soviet Union, Trotsky becomes the great alternative. In other words, he allows people to continue to believe in the original Bolshevik project. They can just point to Stalin as having ruined it. In fact, a lot of that goes on still to today. But in the late 1930s, a lot of people who are disillusioned with the Soviet Union gravitate toward Trotsky.
Mm. Something, though, that seems to me to be really striking is that in Russia, Stalin was so successful in painting Trotsky as the enemy of the people that yet still today there are people in Russia who see Trotsky that way.
In fact, that's true. From about 1929 right through to the end of the Soviet Union, Trotsky was the devil figure in Soviet history. There was nothing like him, even after Stalin died. And you can actually see this in the years of Mikhail Gorbachev, when Gorbachev began to open up the Soviet Union and began to open up the pages of history. He wanted to rehabilitate, that was the word that was used, all kinds of fallen Bolsheviks, people who had been accused in the purge trials, the Moscow trials, and executed or killed in the camps. But when it came to Trotsky, and he was asked directly about this, he said, well, now Trotsky's another thing entirely. Even Gorbachev couldn't rise above that. And today, if people look back at the Soviet Union, they reminisce and they get nostalgic about Stalin, because Stalin was the head of the Soviet Union, Russia was a great country, and so on. But people really have no lost love for Trotsky.
Yeah, and this is some. I'm sure we'll talk about the circumstances of Trotsky's death. But at this point, just I want to mention that the man who attacked Trotsky fatally, as it turned out, was actually given a medal.
He was. When he was allowed, let out of prison after serving his 20-year sentence, he ends up in Moscow, and in a secret Kremlin ceremony, Leonid Brezhnev, who was the number two man at that point to Khrushchev, Leonid Brezhnev pins on him the Order of Lenin as a reward for murdering the evil Trotsky.
I think that for a lot of people, they would think of Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin, any other names that they could name associated with the Russian Revolution, they would think of them all as being the same. And certainly these men, not only did they have personal differences, I'm sure that they also had ideological differences. What about Trotsky separated him from the others?
Well, the first thing to mention is that Trotsky, for most of the time before 1917, was not a Bolshevik. He, in fact, was associated with the rival Menshevik Party, and he joined the Bolsheviks only in May 1917, when he and Lenin got together, and then he became the kind of mastermind of the October Revolution. So that's one thing. And he was always an outsider in the party, and no matter how much he would claim his loyalty to Lenin and Bolshevism, in the 1920s power struggle after Lenin died, Stalin could always claim, and a lot of people believed it, that Trotsky was an outsider, that he really wasn't one of us. That's number one. It should also be mentioned that Trotsky was Jewish. And this was played on subtly as well. Russian anti-Semitism was played on by Stalin in the 1920s, so that was a very big deal. Now, ideologically, in the 1920s power struggle, Trotsky was more to the left. He wanted to move more quickly to collectivize the peasants and to industrialize the country. But then after he was kicked out, it was Stalin who collectivized the peasantry quite brutally, with millions killed, and Stalin who led the first five-year plan and the ones after that. Trotsky was in exile, and Trotsky always claimed that those were his ideas, that he would have carried them out, although less brutally, in a more enlightened fashion. But in fact, if you look back at the 1920s, Trotsky was relatively moderate compared to what Stalin did beginning in 1928, 1929, which is often called the Stalin Revolution. Trotsky and all the other Bolsheviks are actually quite moderate compared to Stalin.
Well, you were talking about the fact that Trotsky, while he was a committed Marxist, was never really a Bolshevik. He apparently, this was his alliance with the Bolsheviks was something that was a pragmatic kind of move on his part, because he felt that they stood the best chance of bringing about the kind of political and societal changes that he wanted to see.
Exactly right. When he arrived back in Russia in May, he realized that the only stage for him, the only way that he could get back to the main sort of stage of national power, because he had been there briefly, in 1905 during that revolution, the only vehicle was Lenin's Bolshevik Party. Up until that time, Trotsky had talked about the importance of political democracy, both within the country and within the party, or any political party that he would be part of. But when he joins Lenin's Bolshevik Party, he puts those principles aside. And that, as I referred to it, is the Faustian pact that he makes between him and Lenin.
Now, he apparently was more willing to have a bigger tent, so to speak, and that others felt that there were certain people that they just couldn't, not only could not live with, maybe that could not live, and that there was this very fundamental difference in, well, who can we work with, who can we stand, who can we allow to live between these men?
Well, let's make one thing clear, that once Trotsky joins the Bolsheviks from 1917 right through to the end when Lenin dies in 1924, Trotsky is as fanatically pro-Bolshevik and is in favor of the Red Terror, one of its architects, in fact, as anyone else. He was the leader, the creator of the Red Army, and as such, he was responsible for ordering the executions of many men, including Bolsheviks who refused to fight. He, in other words, was as fanatical as the others, and it's only when he begins to slip from power, he begins to lose control in the battle with Stalin, that he suddenly discovers the virtues of inner party democracy. But it's too late, and he's being somewhat hypocritical here, and I think he realizes it, and it's all for naught.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Bertrand Patenaude. He is the author of a new book, Trotsky, Downfall of a Revolutionary. It's published by Harper, and it looks at the primarily at the final years of Trotsky's life when he was living in Mexico. Our guest is a lecturer at Stanford University, where he's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution Library and Archives. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk some more about this, the rivalry between Trotsky and Stalin, and to what extent that was about ideology and to what extent that was personal.
Well, ultimately, it becomes personal and political, and the ideology is in the background. Basically, when Lenin dies, the leading Bolsheviks, Stalin among them, unite to form a bloc against Trotsky, because he is indeed seen as the heir apparent. Now, what's interesting is that people think of the 20s as the great dispute between, the great battle, the conflict between Trotsky and Stalin, but in fact, it was really no contest. It turns out that Stalin was a genius in maneuvering in the corridors of power. He was a brilliant political tactician. Trotsky couldn't do anything right politically. He couldn't even organize his own faction. He never would have been able to organize his own political party. Trotsky's strength was as an orator. He was the great orator of 1917. He could speak to the masses. He could get people marching. He could rally people. He could get people to storm the Winter Palace. But once it came, once the masses were taken out of the equation, and it came down to a matter of organizing within a very closed party, Trotsky was finished. And so Stalin was able to outmaneuver him, portraying him as someone who was cosmopolitan, in other words, somebody who believed that the revolution in Russia could succeed only if it succeeded worldwide, as Marx had once said. Trotsky, by the way, had said no such thing, but no matter. And also Stalin portrayed himself as the real sort of national Bolshevik. He played on Russian nationalism. Those things, more than anything else, defeated Trotsky. And really, the contest was over by 1925 when Trotsky lost control of the Red Army.
And, you know, people, when it comes to history, people like to ask these questions. What if some major sort of direction, what if it had gone a different way? And I'm sure that there are people who ask this question, well, what if, in fact, Trotsky had been the successor to Lenin and not Stalin? It sounds as if you are saying that he really wouldn't have had the capability to have been a successful leader, not on the national level.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the idea, first of all, you have to win the conflict, and then you have to accumulate dictatorial power. And Stalin, took a lot of work for Stalin to do. It's impossible to imagine Trotsky ever getting there. It's interesting, in the early days, and in particular in the 1930s, and I talk about this in the book, when Stalin won and Trotsky was in exile, a lot of left-wing, just communist sympathizers, even liberals, said, you know, it's too bad. If Trotsky had won, we would have had a more benign Bolshevism and the Soviet experiment would have lived on and so on. And after World War II, when people looked back, they actually said, if Trotsky had won, things would have been worse because he was that much more fanatical. Look what he did during the Red Terror and look what he did as head of the Red Army. I actually find it very hard to imagine looking at Trotsky, looking at Stalin, the personalities, the background, the education, and the political incompetence of Trotsky versus Stalin, I found it hard to imagine Trotsky coming anywhere near to what Stalin did in terms of brutality as a political leader.
One of the things I'm interested in understanding a little bit more is the idea of the permanent revolution,
right?
And this disagreement about whether or not to be successful the revolution had to expand beyond the boundaries of Russia and its sphere. And was it the case that there were some people who were saying truly that what they were thinking about was a worldwide worker revolution, and that other people said, well, really, if we can accomplish that within Russia and the Soviet Union, that we don't really care much about what happens beyond those boundaries?
Well, here's where this ideological dispute comes in. I always say it's a pseudo-ideological dispute because Stalin fabricated it. The Bolsheviks took power as a small working class, quote-unquote, party in 1917 in October and justified taking power in backward Russia. Remember, Marx said that the first socialist communist revolutions would come in the most advanced capitalist countries. Russia did not fit that description. The Bolsheviks justified taking power in Russia first because they said it would serve as a kind of detonator internationally, and it would spark worldwide revolution. Germany would be next, and then all of Europe and the world. Well, by 1919, it's pretty clear, 1920, 1921, that this is not going to happen. So what do you do? Well, because you're the Bolsheviks, you don't just give up, roll over, and say that the Mensheviks had been right all along, we've come to power too soon. What you do is you have to forge on, you have to keep pushing. Well, Stalin and his allies said, look, Trotsky is the champion of permanent revolution, and that idea of spreading, of Russia being the detonator and of the revolution spreading around the world, that idea, in fact, was Trotsky's, and it was called permanent revolution. And Stalin then said in the 1920s, Trotsky is a defeatist because he believes that unless the revolution comes to the West and we can be rescued by those Germans and others, that we are basically hopeless here. Now, Trotsky never said any such thing. Trotsky said we have to continue to try to build socialism and that ultimately, down the road, we cannot construct a true communist society in Soviet Russia until we have revolution in the West. That's what Trotsky was saying, not throw up our hands and go nowhere, but build with an eye toward revolution in the West in the future. Stalin, though, successfully portrayed him as a defeatist. And again, his Jewish ethnicity was used here, Trotsky the cosmopolitan, Trotsky the non-Russian, and all those things combined helped Stalin to defeat Trotsky.
You talked about the fact that perhaps the beginning of the end for Trotsky was when he lost his position as head of the Red Army. That was in 1925.
Right.
Then in 1927, he was kicked out of the Communist Party,
right.
And then he was exiled from the Soviet Union in 1929. Why did, for Stalin, why was it not sufficient to have him either out of the party or out of the country? Why eventually did it get to the point where Stalin decided that Trotsky had to be dead?
Well, the idea with Stalin is that if things go wrong when he is at the helm, then his rivals and his allies, who might turn out to be rivals, might wish to bring Trotsky back from Central Asia, where he was exiled in 1928. And so also Stalin knew that Trotsky, in his Central Asian exile, was corresponding with other oppositionists who had been exiled, but also those in Moscow. And Stalin, maybe not as famously paranoid as we have all come to assume, but nonetheless, reasonably so, even paranoids have enemies, as they say. Stalin thinks if things go wrong, Trotsky could come back. And so the idea was to get him out of the country. It was still inconceivable that the general secretary of the Communist Party could have a fellow communist, especially somebody like Trotsky, shot. Stalin would later regret that he let Trotsky out of his hands, but the idea was to get him out of the country, and that once he was out of the country, Trotsky would begin to do the kinds of things and associate with the kinds of people that would make him sort of beyond the pale in the Soviet Union, that would, in other words, discredit him. And indeed, this is sort of what ends up happening, and Stalin then becomes, really, he is the dictator by the early 1930s.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is listening here in Urbana, where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. You know, Trotsky was only co-author of the Theory of Permanent Revolution. Dr. Parvus was the other one. And I'm not so sure that I agree with you on the Red Terror thing. But anyway, Stalin executed every single member of Lenin's Central Committee, with the exception of Molotov, who is his puppy. You know, you would think it rather difficult to believe that comrade Lenin would surround himself with such counter-revolutionaries, wouldn't you? And since we're dealing with Mexico, that's your main focus, you might discuss Trotsky's relationship to Frida Kahlo and James P. Cannon. Thank you for taking my call.
All right. Well, why don't we save Frida Kahlo for a moment, and you can respond to the other part of the caller's question.
Well, two things there. He's absolutely right about Dr. Parvus, one of Trotsky's mentors in the early days, being actually probably the true author of the notion of permanent revolution. It's Trotsky who, though, takes it, popularizes it, runs with it, and ends up bringing it as an influence into the Bolshevik Party. That's a very good point. On the second point, it's absolutely true that people look back in the 1930s at all the leading Bolsheviks that Stalin was killing, and they said, now listen, these are the people that Lenin brought into the party and surrounded himself with. That must mean Lenin would be a counter-revolutionary. The absurdity, in other words, of the purge trials, of the Moscow trials of 1936, 37, and 38 became apparent to people who would just stop and think back and realize that if only Molotov is surviving, something's got to be wrong.
We're at our midpoint here. Let me again just quickly introduce our guest, Bertrand Patenaude. He's a lecturer at Stanford University, where he's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution Library and Archives. He's the author of a new book. It's titled Trotsky, Downfall of a Revolutionary, and it's published by Harper. And it does indeed take a look at, in a real sense, the entire life of Trotsky, but concentrates primarily on the last couple of years when he was living in Mexico, where he died. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let's go on and talk now about this final chapter. As you said, he was initially exiled. This was, I suppose, a kind of an internal exile in a sense. He lived for a while in what's now Kazakhstan.
That's right.
And then he was in Turkey. Mm-hmm. He was in France. He was in Norway, and eventually came to live in Mexico.
Right.
How did it happen that in fact he ended up being taken in by Mexico at the end?
Well, in fact, by 1936, August 1936, the first of the Moscow trials begins. Trotsky is the chief defendant in absentia, and he's called a mass murderer, poisoner. He is he's accused of treason, of trying to sell out the Soviet Union to Hitler, to the Japanese. This is only the first of the three trials, but at that moment, the Soviet government begins to pressure Norway to hand Trotsky over, or at least to kick him out. And the fact is, no other country in Europe would take him. So things begin to look really bleak. And Trotsky and his wife Natalia begin to wonder whether they will in fact end up in the hands of the Soviet secret police, the NKVD. And then in the 11th hour, the word comes that Mexico will take in Trotsky. Two things here. One is that Mexico has a very enlightened radical president by the name of Cardenas, a man who is eager to show his independence from the Mexican Communist Party, which is ferociously anti-Trotsky. So Cardenas is open to the idea. And Trotsky has a sponsor in the Mexican muralist Diego Rivera, who is the one who approaches President Cardenas and gets his permission to allow Trotsky in.
And here, this where we get involved with these two remarkably colorful characters, Diego Rivera and his wife, who also was an artist, Frida Kahlo. Rivera apparently was the most prominent Trotskyist in all of Mexico. So perhaps it shouldn't have been surprising that he would be the sponsor of this idea that Trotsky should come to Mexico.
That's right. In fact, the Trotskyists don't even have a party in Mexico. So small is their contingent there. It's called a faction. And Diego, an outsized character, I mean, just a really sort of an amazing character in the book. I could have filled up many more pages talking about the quirks of Diego Rivera, not to mention the great art. Diego is easily the largest figure in many ways among the Mexican Trotskyists, and so he's the man who naturally takes the lead.
Did the government of Mexico think that having Trotsky there would cause any particular problems?
Well, I think, again, it's a matter of President Cárdenas trying to do the right thing. This is a very unusually enlightened leader, but also someone who was trying to put some distance between the very powerful Mexican Communist Party and its unions. It's pretty clear, though, that the Mexican government did not realize what it was getting into in the sense of the assassination efforts that would be led by the Soviet government and which would eventually succeed.
Well, it doesn't seem that the Mexican government took the idea that there would be security concerns and that his life might be threatened, that is, Trotsky's life might be threatened. It seems that the Mexican government really didn't take that very seriously.
Well, I think they underestimated it. It's very clear. There's a statement, I quoted in the book, Cárdenas saying to one of the American Trotskyists who came down from New York just before Trotsky landed, saying, listen, Trotsky is not going to be a prisoner here. He can come and go as he pleases. He can move around and so on. Well, that becomes possible in a limited fashion. But even from the beginning, Trotsky needed four or five armed bodyguards even to go out for a picnic. So I think the Mexican government is pretty clear, underestimated the security dilemma.
So what was the relationship like between Rivera and Trotsky?
Well, from the beginning, it's pretty clear, and it was clear to some of Trotsky's young acolytes that this was going to be trouble. Rivera was a free spirit, arguably not really a Marxist, also a very unpredictable, very sort of impulsive character, including with his politics. He would tend to lunge from one direction to the other. He had trouble telling the truth, which bothered Trotsky a lot. Also, just personality-wise, he would lose the thread of a conversation. He would tell off-color jokes. Trotsky was very straight-laced, and that would make Trotsky uncomfortable. Trotsky, very angular, very exacting, very disciplined. Diego's only discipline, really, was when he was on the scaffold painting. Otherwise, everything kind of let go, including his finances. So the friendship lasted for a couple of years, but really at that point begins to unravel.
Yeah. The thing about Trotsky was he was not so straight-laced to avoid having an affair with Frida Kahlo, and I'm sure that Diego Rivera wasn't real happy about that, and I'm sure that Mrs. Trotsky was also not real happy about that.
Well, first of all, the affair did happen. I mean, there was some question a few years ago as to whether this really ever took place. Most definitely, Trotsky began an affair with Diego Rivera's wife, Frida Kahlo. For Frida, it was by far not her first extramarital affair. In fact, she followed her husband Diego's example. He was a big philanderer. She became that as well. For Trotsky, though, it's pretty clear that although he had had affairs in the Soviet Union, this was the first time since he had left the country that the opportunity had come up. We should also be clear that the thing is short-lived, that it puts his marriage in a very big crisis, which I talk about in some detail, but that Diego Rivera never found out. The fact is, Trotsky and Diego would have a break over political and personal matters later on. 2 years later, if Diego had found out about the affair, Trotsky's exile, indeed his life, might have ended much earlier. Diego carried a gun, and used it to threaten people. The idea that if this had become public, that the great Diego Rivera had been embarrassed in this way by Leon Trotsky, the man whom he had given refuge in Mexico, who knows what would have happened?
I'm glad for the correction. Perhaps I was not reading closely enough. I guess my impression was that somehow that the affair between Frida Kahlo and Trotsky contributed to the falling out between the two men.
Well, I must tell you that it's very interesting. There are two myths that die hard. One has to do with a certain ice pick that we'll talk about, no doubt, in a few minutes. And the other one is the fact that Diego broke with Trotsky over this affair, that he was really angry. I think part of this is because in the film Frida, which is a very popular film, very good film, in there, Diego finds out about it and, you know, kicks Trotsky out of his house, and therefore Trotsky is killed. All fiction. And I will tell you that the reviews of the book, of my book, in the UK, it came out in June over there, a good half dozen reviews, good reviews by well-known people, step into the hole of saying that Diego found out about the affair and was very angry. He never did, but that myth dies hard. It seems only natural that Diego would find out. It didn't happen.
All right. Let's talk with another caller here, someone in Effingham. This is our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. A couple of things. I missed a few minutes, but Trotsky and Lenin were the face and muscle of the Russian Revolution, and their intellectual capacities and their looking ahead, I think, was a phenomena that threatened capitalism to a point that they could not bear to have those things go on. And Stalin, you know, of course, played into it, Iron Curtain and all. But the thing that I guess I need to have your guest answer, or if he has not already, about the philosophy of Trotsky and his work on what he called the permanent revolution, which, for all intents and purposes, is the future, or there is no future.
Actually, let me build on, since we did talk about permanent revolution a little bit earlier, let me just build on this and tell you that once Trotsky gets into exile and Stalin is executing the so-called Great Turn, the rapid industrialization of the country under the first five-year plan and the brutal forced collectivization of the peasantry, millions would die, but this would create the so-called socialist economy. The government would run both agriculture as in collective farms and industry as well, with the plans and all the kinds of figures. This is the kind of thing that the Marxist-Leninists had talked about. Stalin makes it happen. I said earlier that Trotsky always said, I would have done the same thing, but less brutally, in a more enlightened fashion. The problem for Trotsky is that he could never disown the Soviet Union. Even in this period in Mexico, when Stalin, when the regime in Moscow is trying to have him killed, when those three purged great sensational Moscow show trials make him the main defendant in absentia, Trotsky is defending Moscow when Hitler attacks, or rather when the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany form their pact in 1939, and then they divide up Eastern Europe. Trotsky cannot let go. He keeps insisting that the Soviet Union is a worker state. It's a degenerated worker state, he says, but it's still a worker state, and we have to save the accomplishments, the achievements of October 1917. All we need is a political revolution to oust Stalin. The problem is he keeps defending the Soviet Union right up through the invasion of Eastern Poland, the takeover of the Baltics, and the invasion of Finland. And this, I cover in the book, puts a lot of stress and strain on the American Trotskyists, most of whom cannot find anything to legitimize the Soviet takeover of Eastern Europe. And they begin to say outright, Trotsky's wrong. It's not a worker state. This is the final crisis for Trotsky, ideological, if you will. But it's so clear that if he disowned the Soviet Union, he would have to give up on October 1917, Red October, his great life's accomplishment, and he wouldn't do it.
Could I make one more comment, David?
Sure.
The very things you've just articulated had already happened, at least 500 years earlier, and the Western Europeans and their spreading of their gospel of colonialism and capitalism on the known world, and then the backward royalist nation of Russia, who had begun, had a small bourgeois class, and had begun to find strength there, and then with the either looking the other way or helping that small bourgeois class in Russia to expand, and then the same thing would happen over again. That's why I consider myself a Trotskyist, because he did mention and write about it, and I read the volume, and it took me a while, and the permanent revolution. And that's exactly what happened to the capitalist ideas, which was permanently, which is still permanent, and it moves in those frames in order to legitimize itself and to strengthen their stranglehold on humanity. And I just can't get past the vilification of anyone who would has the audacity to oppose Western colonialist ideals, and then think that everybody else were mass murderers and were wrong and all such things. The patriarchal movement, which is what it still is, that is their logo.
Well, let me just say, as a general point, that in the last few years, with the economic downturn is too soft a word, recession is probably too soft a word, this depression we're in, the stock of people, this is probably not the most felicitous turn of phrase here, but the stock of people like Marx and even Lenin and even Trotsky has gone up, if only because of an apparent crisis of capitalism, and people have begun to look to Marx, Engels, Lenin, not Stalin, but Trotsky, for ideas and maybe for some insights.
We have just about 10 minutes left, a little bit more in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Bertrand Patenaude. He's a lecturer at Stanford University, where he's a research fellow with the Hoover Institution Library and Archives. He's the author of a new book, Trotsky, Downfall of a Revolutionary. It is published by Harper, and it looks closely at the last couple of years of Trotsky's life when he was living in Mexico. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. So at what point did Stalin decide that it was so important that Trotsky be eliminated that he actually organized a program? It actually even had a budget for his assassination, and was fairly specific about the circumstances.
Yes, that's right. In August of 1938, keep in mind, the three purge trials are now over, those three sensational Moscow trials. Trotsky has served his purpose. He was abroad. They could invent all kinds of charges to hurl against him and invent all kinds of allies of Trotsky's inside the Soviet Union, put them on trial. But by now they're all dead, or most of them are. So the question is, what do we do with Trotsky? Well, look, he's enemy number one. You can't let him sit out there, especially because the war is coming. Stalin knew the war was coming with Hitler. So August 1938, in fact, is the organization of so-called Operation Duck, D-U-C-K, and it might have been called Operation Sitting Duck, the idea being to spend as much money as was required, in this case $31,000 was the budget, to eliminate Trotsky. And they came up with a variety of options. Storming his home with bombs and guns, poison, a dagger, gunshot, anything. All options were open, and Stalin approved the plan and handed it over to operatives who then went to work trying to come up with the best operation.
Hmm. He died as a result of this attack that took place in the summer, August of 1940. There was an earlier attempt in May His house was attacked by a number of armed men. Interestingly enough, led by a painter. I'm to the point where I feel like maybe one should never say anything bad about a painter.
Well, it's interesting. As soon as I bring up a painter in the book, I always feel I should put a warning, or you hear that ominous music in the background. One of the big three Mexican muralists, the other was Orozco, whom Trotsky meets in the book. But the other one, it was Rivera, Orozco, and David Alfaro Siqueiros, who was the most radical politically of the three. And he led a raid of 20 men. This was organized by the NKVD, the Soviet Secret Police. They came in with machine guns and bombs, and they had a mole on the inside of Trotsky's house. He opened the doors for them, middle of the night, May 1940. There was a crossfire from three ways into Trotsky and Natalia's bedroom. The guards were pinned down with machine gun fire. I opened the book with this. It's so dramatic. It's so compelling. And they miss. And they retreat thinking Trotsky's dead, and they never touched him. A few scratches from flying glass. That was the failed attempt. And what happens at that point, this is late May 1940, is that Trotsky and his bodyguards, mostly young Americans, begin to build up the fortress. They put up netting against bombs. They build the walls higher. They put observation towers up. They think that the next attack will be a similar type, but with bombs. It will be a lot of men. It will be in the middle of the night. So they beef up the guard, beef up the security. They're wrong about that. They end up trying to fight the last war because, in fact, as soon as that raid ended and failed in May 1940, the NKVD decided on Plan B, and that was a lone assassin, a man named Ramon Mercader, whom they recruited in Spain during the Spanish Civil War and who had managed to seduce one of Trotsky's part-time secretaries, and he was known to the people in the household, and he was able to penetrate the household and eventually, in August 1940, be alone with Trotsky in his study.
Hmm. So this was someone who they had was an agent of the secret police. Perhaps they, at the time that he was recruited, who knows what sort of idea, what plans they had for him. But so was he deliberately infiltrated, instructed to try and get himself somehow into Trotsky's circle, or at maybe the question would be, at what point did that happen?
Well, it's pretty clear from the testimony right after the assassination that he was a penetration agent, and he was just supposed to provide information and maybe help the real assassins who would come in and kill Trotsky, and that it was not something that he had anticipated when he was summoned to New York from Mexico in June of 1940 and told that he would be the assassin. His health begins to go south at that point. His quote-unquote wife, his American girlfriend, the Trotskyist, notices that he becomes green in the face and nervous and he's losing weight and so on. It's very clear that his mission change was not something he anticipated.
Yeah. He, because he had this association with the member of the household, essentially, managed to get in. He attacked Trotsky with what is, you earlier talked about the ice pick. I think that's often described as an ice pick, and people think of this old-fashioned tool that people used when they actually had blocks of ice, this thing that kind of looked like a long pin or nail or something that had a handle. I think actually what this was the kind of thing that mountain climbers use. So it was a much more serious and kind of frightening weapon that he managed to smuggle in and then use to attack Trotsky.
Exactly right. It was a pickaxe, and one end was pointed in the way a pickaxe would, in the way of an ice pick would be. And so people often talk about an ice pick. He used that pointed side. He sawed off the long wooden handle, hid it under his raincoat. By the way, he was also carrying a revolver and a very long dagger. And we'll never know why, but for some reason it was the pickaxe. His idea was to strike Trotsky dead and then slip out of the house. No one was in the study with them. Slip out of the house. The killer's mother, also recruited by the NKVD, and a Russian operative were waiting a couple of blocks away in separate cars. Ramon was supposed to do the deed, drive his own car a couple of blocks away, hop in their car, and leave the country. But in fact, the blow struck, and it didn't kill Trotsky, who screamed, struggled, and, well, we can leave the rest to readers.
Yeah. So apparently he must have thought that this would actually have been the most quiet way of accomplishing the deed, and if possible, then he could kill Trotsky, then he could slip out and he could get away.
Exactly right, and the fact is he could still have done it. He had the dagger, he had the revolver, and when the American guards rushed in Trotsky's study, the killer, the assassin, was standing there, and the revolver was dangling in his hands, but he was an emotional wreck, and he started to scream at them, "Kill me, kill me," and then began to invent stories about why he had done what he did.
He survived, though, as we explained earlier, that eventually he did make his way back to Russia, and he was awarded a medal for his work in ultimately killing Trotsky.
That's right. In fact, three awards, the most important being the Order of Lenin, and very quietly, though, secret Kremlin ceremony. But it's a measure, again, of how Trotsky was viewed in the Soviet Union, that had that been made public at the time, and even much later, most Russians, most Soviet citizens really would not have questioned it, because as bad as Stalin was, a lot of them probably did think that Trotsky was as bad or would have been worse.
This man, Ramon Mukherjee, he did spend, am I right in remembering, he did actually spend some time in prison?
He spent 20 years. He served his entire sentence. Twice the NKVD and later the KGB had plans to spring him from prison. And one of those attempts was foiled by the killer's own mother, who returned to Mexico, was distraught about having delivered her son into the hands of the NKVD, and she got in the way of it. But in any case, he remained there the entire time, never confessed. In 1954, it came out what his real identity was, that he was not who he said he was, which was a Belgian, but he was in fact a Spaniard. But he never confessed anything, and he got his reward when he got back to the Soviet Union.
I wonder how it was that he was not executed for the attack on Trotsky.
Mexico didn't have a death penalty.
So what the consequences? What were the consequences of as far as the movement that he was associated with? The consequences of Trotsky's death.
Well, in fact, you can see that this quote unquote Trotskyist movement, which was biggest in the United States, was really coming apart and losing its way as Hitler's armies and Stalin's Red Army divided up Eastern Europe, and Trotsky was struggling. His death only made it easier for people who were going to exit from the left and from communism to do so even more quickly, because Trotsky was gone. And many of them then speculated that Trotsky would have done the same thing. In other words, that he would have abandoned the Soviet Union and started a different project completely.
And to go back to make, say, one other point that we did actually, for anyone maybe who didn't hear the conversation as we started out, during the history of the revolution, there would have been a number of people who at one point or another were labeled enemies. Some of them, a lot of them, were officially rehabilitated. He was one of the few that never was, and as we discussed a little bit at the beginning, to this day, there are people in Russia who still think of Trotsky as being essentially a traitor, a demon, at the very least, the enemy of the people.
Absolutely. And somebody put it well in a review that there's just no lost love. Trotsky, you read this book, and you see that Trotsky doesn't really miss his homeland. He doesn't miss Russia. He's truly a cosmopolitan, truly a man of the world. And the Russians today return the favor. They have no time for Trotsky. They're on to other things. And again, to the extent that they are nostalgic about things Soviet, it's about the great power status of the Soviet Union under Stalin.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of idea or picture of Trotsky would you like to leave with people?
Well, this is a man who was an absolute fanatic and about his ideological convictions, and who held on to the very end at the cost of his followers and indeed even his family, but a man who, in fact, as John Dewey, the American philosopher who was involved in trying to exonerate Trotsky from the charges in the Purge trial, said, a man who was brilliant, but who was locked up in those absolutes of Marxism-Leninism, and what a waste.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Bertrand Patenaude, he's a lecturer at Stanford University, where he is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution Library and Archives. And if you'd like to read the book that we've talked about, the title is Trotsky, Downfall of a Revolutionary. It's published by HarperCollins. And Professor Patenaude, thank you very much for talking with us.
David, I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.